Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the SBAI podcast. The SBAI is a global alliance of asset managers and institutional investors dedicated to improving the alternative investment industry. We do this by setting standards, providing industry guidance, and facilitating collaboration through our community of over 250 institutional investors and asset managers. Our community is responsible for approximately $8 trillion US dollars in assets.
My name is Brian Digney, and I'm the Research and Content Director at the Standards Board for Alternative Investments. Today, I'm joined in conversation with Benedict Getty and Josh Medeiros from KEDU Credit. KEDU Credit are a specialist underwriter offering portfolio credit insurance. Ben and Josh will share their views on how this evolving area of the insurance industry works in practice and how it can be used as a hedging and de-risking strategy for private credit and debt portfolios. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Josh and Ben from KEDU, who are coming to speak to us today about the evolution in the insurance environment and specifically portfolio credit insurance. This is another podcast in our series of podcasts focusing on insurance and its relationship with the asset management sector. And I'm delighted to be joined by you two gentlemen today. So Ben and Josh, do you maybe want to just take a moment to introduce yourselves and your organization, maybe starting with you, Josh?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Brian. So my name is Josh. I'm at KEDU Credit, and we launched about a year ago today to offer non-payment solutions into the non-bank space, which is our focus. My background has been within the credit insurance industry, initially on the structured credit side in a broking role, and then later on the underwriting side.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, so my name's Ben. I'm the other half of KEDU. Known Josh for quite a while now, and we're having a good time getting the business up and running off the ground. But as Josh says, we've been running for about a year so far, and everything's been, really interesting. And as you know, sort of very much focusing on the non-bank FI space, clients in the alternative investment space.
Perfect. So perhaps I can set the scene a bit. We have seen in the last number of years a significant increase in the amount of external allocations that are going into private credit portfolios. And that is because traditional banking institutions are exiting the space, and this requirement and this demand is being taken up by private organizations. So whenever we talk about portfolio credit insurance, it isn't necessarily a brand new product. This has been around for a while, but its relevance to the banking sector is obviously still there, but it could be even more relevant for the asset management sector. So for you, Ben, could you maybe explain to us what it is, how it works, and this link to the private credit and private debt space?
Yeah, that's right. So, I think you've got it spot on there. So it's a sophisticated product. It's a market that's been around for a long time, as you say, circa 100 years since post-World War One. Originally, I would say, it's developed as an insurance product from where it was traditionally used by exporters. As you say, in recent decades, it's been used by banks, export credit agencies, traders, corporates. But as you say, that element of the portfolio approach has been particularly relevant for business in the non-bank FI space, non-bank lender space. And to your point, what is it? What are we really talking about? So credit insurance or non-payment insurance is basically a product that indemnifies the policyholder, indemnifies the insured for losses that have been sustained as a result of a default or an insolvency by one or more obligors covered by the policy. So it's very broad, and fundamentally we're talking about non-payment broadly for any reason. And we, later on we can kind of get into, there's, a few exclusions, but broadly it's non-payment, non-delivery for any reason whatsoever.
Yeah, I think that's a very good overview. Josh, what are the main types of coverage that are available and what can you actually deliver? I presume that there's a huge spectrum of different solutions that are on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the great thing about the non-payment insurance space is that, as you say, there is really a full spectrum. Each policy is very much tailored to the underlying debt obligation or obligations that the policyholder is looking to purchase some sort of risk transfer on. So unlike, other sort of more liquid credit products where you have some level of basis risk, non-payment insurance is really, really targeted at what it is you're looking to offload or sell down. So the two core structures are single risk. And when we say single risk, we mean policies that are set up to capture a single loan or single transaction or loan facility. And then the portfolio side, which is sort of, you know, the area that we focus on, the area that we see becoming ever more relevant, which is where you're capturing kind of an entire fund or a tranche within an entire fund, you know, fundamentally a multitude of loans rather than one individual loan.
Just to kind of jump in there, I think what's quite relevant probably for your members is just to touch on how the product can be used specifically when we're talking about, you know, private credit and debt instruments. So how we've seen it used in the past sort of, let's say, 10 or so years and the value it adds really is to improve the risk-adjusted return profile of the debt instruments. So it can be used to facilitate leverage. It can be used to reduce the cost of funds and manage concentrations. And broadly, you know, when you are talking about insurers who are able to offer credit insurance with, you know, double A minus rated paper, for example, what that really means is, particularly when we're talking about lenders, whether it's bank and non-bank, that ability to have double A minus rated paper that sits across the portfolio helps in all of those ways. And that's, I think, where we've really seen more of the clients in your space starting to use the product.
So from the perspective of someone who maybe trades, let's say, listed corporate debt, you would have typically available the option to purchase credit default swaps on that instrument to protect yourself. If you were an equity manager, you could possibly enter a range of hedging solutions. You could buy equity puts. You can enter swap arrangements. So what you're saying for private debt and private credit is that this is really a de-risking option that is available to managers rather than just a pure traditional insurance product. Is that how people should think about it?
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's spot on.
So Josh, in terms of how managers actually use this product, you mentioned that there was the option to do it on a line by line basis or do it, you know, at the entire portfolio level. What is the typical approach and how do managers think about what level of coverage they want to actually have?
Yeah, so I think it's very transaction dependent. So it sort of depends what the manager is looking to achieve out of the product. I mean, you know, there's a full range from insurance policies that cover, you know, 90% of a portfolio above a 10% first loss down to sort of targeting a 10% mezzanine tranche or preferred equity issuance, as well as ground up cover where, you know, you're covering the entire portfolio. There's no first loss, but there is a proportional risk share between the insurance policy and the manager. So in terms of gauging that, it really depends on what the manager is looking to achieve. If it's a specific share class that they're targeting or a specific debt facility or note issuance that they're looking to provide additional protection to and de-risk that segment of the portfolio, then they should be looking at an insurance policy that specifically targets that. I think as a general rule, insurers expect a minimum risk share of 10%, but that can be sort of vertical. So as I said, a proportional share, or it can be horizontal where they look at sort of a first loss retention by the manager and then structuring the insurance in excess of that.
In terms of how these policies are actually put together and how they're structured, what does that look like?
So there's two main approaches in structuring these policies, two common approaches, I would say. The first is where you have the investment vehicle or the SPV that's actually holding the assets, as well as the investment manager or investment advisor is co-insured under the policy. The reason for that is the investment vehicle is where what we refer to as insurable interest is, which is, you know, the underlying debt assets, but it's up to the investment manager in terms of compliance with policy terms and conditions. And so from an insurer's perspective, you like to have those two sort of different elements. If you do have funders sat behind the fund from a debt perspective or even an equity perspective, you know, you can structure it so that they're loss payee, so they're the ultimate beneficiary if there is a claim. But you look at having, as I say, sort of the investment vehicle and the manager as the named insureds on the policy. The second main setup is where you're targeting the funders to the SPV themselves. So you'd also have anyone who sort of has any interest in a note issuance or a loan to the SPV named on the policy as a co-insured. What that does is it shifts the obligation to comply with the terms and conditions to that funder, but it can be beneficial if that funder is looking to achieve any sort of regulatory recognition in terms of effective credit risk transfer off the back of the fact that this is now an insured investment rather than an unrated investment.
Okay, that's a great overview. Ben, with every insurance policy, there's different choices people can make. We've heard from your colleague Mike previously about even the complexities of basic insurance policies like E&O and D&O coverage. this sounds like a slightly more complex area than even the more traditional insurance policy types. So what are the mistakes that people can make whenever they're entering this space, and what should they look out for?
Sure. So I think kind of taken into the realm, and if you have a look at, for example, how some of the big banks have used the product in the past and where a lot of the more structured, complex part of the market came from, single risks, you know, large policies placed in exotic locations with large counterparties where, for example, a bank is, you know, selling down $200 million of risk. That was, you know, an effective way for banks to get capital relief, and it did work. I think where businesses in the private debt and private credit space have gone wrong is when maybe they've tried to replicate that same way. So, you know, you've come to the market, you know, you're a new insured, you haven't got a relationship with the insurers that you're trying to approach. And you come to them and you say, right, well, here's my portfolio of 30 or 40 names, you know, 50 names, and here are three or four names that I'm going to try and sell down to the market, or one or two names that you sell down to the market. And I think how insurers have perceived this traditionally has been, well, this new insurer to the market is coming in, they're looking to trade down, this could be negative selection, they're looking to trade down businesses that they may perceive issues coming up with. And generally what we've seen is that this hasn't been a particularly good way of building relationships, of getting things placed in the market. People have said, look, this isn't a huge reason for us to dedicate a lot of time to underwrite this business. So it hasn't been a strategy that's worked. Where we see better performance tends to be where there's a consistent strategy. And what we have seen as being a particularly good route down this path is looking across a portfolio. So where you have a client who is saying, we're strategically using insurance across all of the names, we're not negatively selecting, we're not bringing one or two different names, but we're using a consistent strategy, that's where we see businesses doing well. And similarly, that point around, you know, having skin in the game, if you look across a portfolio and you, for example, say, we'll keep the equity portion of the risk clean, but transfer the leverage part of the portfolio to credit insurers, for example, to drive down the cost of funds and attract better banks, that strategy works and people understand that. And it's so much better than just saying, here's a single risk, which we're not quite sure about in a difficult region.
Josh, maybe you could take us through the process of settling a claim and some of the common reasons why some of those claims might get denied.
So to start with the first element of your question around claim settlement and the timelines for that, typically a policy will contain a waiting period, which is a period of time between a non-payment event occurring and the claim value being determined. The market standard for that is 180 days for default or protracted default. If the non-payment event is a result of an insolvency, then that's much shorter. That's, you know, 30 days, sometimes even less. But what's really important about the credit insurance product is that it needs to demonstrate timely indemnification. And obviously with banks as the historical kind of core purchaser of this product, for regulatory reasons, that's something that insurers have really had to evidence that the product does perform in a timely manner. Going over to the second piece of your question on claims denial, I mean, the primary reasons a claim could be denied would be due to non-compliance with the terms and conditions of the policy. So any warranties or conditions precedent within that policy, any failure to comply with those could result in a claim denial. But to be honest, those conditions are usually pretty standardized. They're usually fairly self-explanatory. I mean, we're talking the requirement that the debt obligation is legally enforceable, that the policyholder complies with any relevant laws, them maintaining some sort of risk share or uninsured retention as prescribed by the policy, things like that. Looking a bit more historically in terms of the success of claims payouts, I think the most recent comprehensive data is a few years out of date now, but the market in the 12 years to 2020 paid out $3.3 billion in claims to financial institutions. And again, you know, being able to really evidence this is one of the core reasons why the product is accepted by the regulatory regimes in terms of capital relief.
So Ben, whenever a client or a potential client comes to you and says, we want to insure our portfolio, obviously you're exposed or you're going to expose yourself to a certain degree of risk. What is your process to underwrite the risk within a private debt portfolio to get comfortable with the exposure that you're taking on?
So from our perspective, we tend to look at the three main pillars of the stool. So that is broadly who the insured is, what the structure is and what the fundamental risk is. Particularly in the frame of non-bank financial institutions, private debt, often we're talking about businesses that maybe have a less strong regulatory structure than banks, for example. They may have been around a little bit less time. So from our perspective, who the insured is absolutely key. So we will go into detail looking at the risk management, the contract risk management, credit risk management, processes of the underlying insured. We will try to understand what their experience is in the market. We will look at who the managers are. And broadly, what we're going to look at is, are they looking to partner with an insurer over the long run, or are they looking to use the product when they think something's already gone wrong? I also think on that point, what's important is transparency. And that's something that I think we've particularly looked at for businesses in the non-bank lending space is, are they prepared to open the door to us, to treat us as a partner, to have us involved? So, you know, we've seen businesses in this space who, for example, allowed our credit analysts to come and sit in their offices, understand their processes for a couple of days at a time. And that approach of transparency is really important. So, you know, are they sharing credit memos with us? Are they prepared to really go into detail explaining how they approach risk, how they underwrite risk? Because for us and for them, I think, you know, long-term partnership is about understanding each other and who the insured is. So I think, you know, to that previous point around why are they utilizing credit insurance, you know, there's a saying in our market, which is that credit insurance isn't there to make a bad contract good. So I think, you know, fundamentally, we want to see clients who are purchasing for the right reasons. So are they using this as a growth tool? Are they using this to target, you know, larger lines on better rated borrowers? Or, you know, are they allowing their portfolio, are they using the product to allow their portfolio to be rated, for example, or to attract a different class of investors? These are all things that I think, you know, we think of as positive reasons to be using it. When we have instances where you're seeing delays or you suspect issues with a borrower and then you approach the market, you know, once the fund's already set up, you know, it's been running for a while, you know, then there may an issue may be seen. For us, it's the equivalent of, you know, trying to get house insurance when you've smelled a gas leak. You know, it's that sort of coming in after the fact. A couple of the other points we picked up on, you know, what the underlying risk is. Of course, you know, we approach risk much like, you know, a lot of these lenders will. So, you know, we've got credit analysts on board. We'll look at the financial credit worthiness. We'll, of course, look at the macro picture as well. So, you know, what the country is, what the commodity risk is, for example. And then I think experience with the counterparty is key as well. So, you know, to what extent do the clients know them? Have they had a long-term relationship with them that they're, you know, trying to increase what they're able to trade with them on, for example? And then finally, that third part of the stool, what the structure is. So from our perspective, is the client taking a self-insured retention? You know, that point around skin in the game, that helps with pricing, of course, but fundamentally from our perspective, it helps us get the deal over the line because it makes us feel that the client is partnering with us. They're not just looking to transfer everything away, but they're looking to really come into that partnership and they themselves trust in their own risk management and they trust in the underlying risk.
I think that's pretty interesting what you've just said, because what I've essentially heard is that there's two elements to this. There's the underlying credit risk within the portfolio, but actually it sounds like there's a huge amount of this pricing and the underwriting process being focused on the organization itself, its size, its sophistication, its commitment to standards, and all of these other things that are very, very common in terms of how I think a lot of allocators would look at potential managers that they want to allocate to in terms of doing IDD and ODD. So there's a lot of things that you guys are looking for that are, would be very common and certainly understandable to the investors who are allocating to these managers as well. So we mentioned the underwriting process and the credit worthiness of the underlying portfolio. Josh, could you maybe just give us a brief overview on that process aside from who the asset manager is, their governance, their organization, how long they've been around. How do you assess the creditworthiness of the actual underlying portfolio?
Yeah, so typically the standard approach is very similar to, as Ben said, you would sort of expect to see in a lender. So, you know, looking at sort of bottom-up fundamental credit analysis, it's become very commonplace, certainly in recent years, that within a credit insurance team, you have dedicated credit analysts, usually from the banking world, chartered accountants, who operate almost independently in the sense that, you know, it's their job to almost ignore the commercial elements to the deal, right? Their primary function is to scrutinize the risk. And then you've obviously got the underwriters as well who take a slightly more comprehensive, holistic view that captures both the commercial as well as the risk. What is available on a much more limited segment of the market. So we're talking maybe 5 or 10 out of 60 insurers are equipped to underwrite from a top-down perspective as well when you're looking at portfolios. And this is something that's growing as we've been discussing. You know, the portfolio style product is becoming more commonplace. And as it does, there's more insurance capability for that. And that's the mechanism we find works best personally is looking at both the sort of bottom-up fundamentals on each individual transaction within a portfolio. But we also want to make sure we take a top-down view. We want to make sure we look at the portfolio composition, the balance, read into any diversification benefit, look at historical volatility to make sure that we're properly appreciating those often very positive factors in our pricing.
Ben, this seems like a very complex area of insurance. How does this product become affected by things that we see in the wider world, macroeconomic conditions, increases in interest rates, inflation, you know, geopolitically, there's a lot of risk out there. How does that affect the underwriting process?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So fundamentally, the answer is that it does affect the underwriting process. It affects pricing. It affects how people perceive risk. I think, for example, if we look back at the last 10 years, the market had a bit of a squeeze, particularly when we saw, you know, the post COVID period, you know, a lot of markets pulled out, for example, or a number of markets pulled out or said they're not writing new business for a while. Similarly, you know, Russia, Ukraine, as you can imagine, affected the market in many ways because a lot of insurers were exposed to this risk. But I think, you know, fundamentally, the point really is that insurers take these macro conditions on board, but that each of them are very much specialists in the areas that they focus on. So if you think about, you know, what the credit insurance market really is, you know, it's really the equivalent of going into Hatton Garden and looking to buy, you know, a type of jewelry. Now, some people are going to be experts in rings, some people are going to be experts in necklaces, and, you know, that could be political risk insurance, that could be credit insurance. But what I think is important to remember is, you know, fundamentally, you're talking about 20, 30, 50 different markets, all of whom have different specialties. So if you, you know, go into the ring market, for example, and you try and buy a necklace, you probably won't necessarily get exactly what you're looking for. I think what I really mean there is that the need to approach the right underwriting team who focus on the area that you're looking at is fundamental to being able to get business over the line, particularly in difficult macroeconomic conditions. And I think on that point, you know, having a good broker is an important point as well. You know, having a helpful facilitator, someone who understands how to engage in a complicated structure and who's attentive to what's needed from your perspective, you as a client's perspective. And on that point, I think a broker who encourages the tripartite relationship, brokers who keep clients at arm's length away from insurers, I think are doing their clients a disservice. Brokers who are prepared to take a new client, to bring the right 10 or so markets, 5 or so markets from, as I say, you know, a market of 50 different insurers, bring the right insurers in the room, the specialist insurers in the room, and to help facilitate a conversation that can really deliver value to the client. I think that is a very powerful way to use the product. But just coming into our market and sort of spraying a, you know, A4 piece of paper around, which may have worked, you know, in recent years, I think in the current climate is a difficult way to approach it.
I think you make a great point, which will not be unfamiliar to our listeners. This seems like any other service provider relationship that we see in asset management, be it a fund administrator, be it a counterparty, what you're effectively saying is that managers and investors should be questioning the type of organization that they're partnering with, that they have the skills, the sophistication to know the product, to be committed to it, to not pull out after a number of years of, you know, losses, and really show a level of expertise in the sector to ensure that they can be a partner for the long term, as you say. So I think this is a great point and something that our listeners should certainly take away. So if you're an asset manager, you really should ask those pertinent questions of your brokers and your underwriters. If you're an investor, you should certainly ask these questions of your asset managers who are employing this type of product, about the people who are behind those products and who are putting them on the table. So certainly something to take away and be mindful of. Let's just pivot to the current environment in terms of market trends. I mean, Josh, what are we seeing here in terms of the market at the moment? We're obviously, there's a lot of economic volatility out there, but what is the demand curve like for this type of product?
So we're definitely seeing more interested in portfolio coverage. I think, you know, a lot of institutions have realized that the non-payment product is a very efficient mechanism to hedge their portfolio. You know, new alternative structures are coming into the market, more unique, esoteric types of instruments. And particularly when you look at, I think, the underlying composition of a lot of these portfolios, in recent years, the market has been quite used to seeing sort of investment grade tier credits from the large banks who are bringing that to market because of regulatory reasons. Obviously, the typical sort of private credit portfolio isn't quite that far up the credit curve. So on a single situation basis, it can be a bit more challenging to find adequate coverage for your sort of single B plus equivalent names, double B minus equivalent names. Portfolio products with a first loss retention are a really efficient solution to that. And from a pricing perspective and economics perspective, we see that working very well kind of on both sides of the equation. But generally speaking, NBFIs, non-bank lenders, do have a way to go in terms of catching up with banks and how they're using the portfolio product. Over the last 5-10 years, you know, there's been an emergence of significant risk transfer product issuance that we've seen banks sort of leveraging the capital markets to offload entire tranches of portfolios. Insurers have started to step into that space too, providing unfunded solutions for that. And that's really what I think sort of spurred on the sophistication of the portfolio products that are available. But non-bank lenders, for the most part, aren't fully sort of invested in exploring those solutions at this point in time.
It's certainly an interesting insight. And maybe just to reference at the start, you said it's a soft environment. That's a kind of very specific term in the insurance world. And I think we have covered this on previous webinars and podcasts at the SBI. But just for everyone's benefit, soft should be interpreted as cheaper insurance or more competitive environment for insurers. How would you describe it?
Yeah, a soft market is generally characterized by lower premium rates. It's characterized by really the fact that loss ratios have been lower in recent times and are sort of projected to stay stable, which enables insurers to offer more competitive pricing for the customers coming in and purchasing the products.
Just to kind of add a quick point there, I think to Josh's point, you know, why does prices fall? Well, prices fall because there's more capacity, there's more insurers. It's in a way quite an exciting time to be in the credit insurance market space. It used to be very much, you know, a sort of forgotten area of the market. It was, you know, slightly complicated. You know, people who were more traditionally sort of property insurance wouldn't understand it so much. But we're seeing a huge rump of new insurers coming to the market, including ourselves, coming with, you know, strong platforms, strong approaches to risk. And that's incredibly exciting place to be. And it's also a time where the more traditional insurers are really starting to sit up and realize that credit insurance is something that can deliver a huge amount of value to clients across the spectrum. So it just feels like, yeah, a lot more capacity. It's as Josh says, you know, you're in a price environment which is cheap for some areas for the right kind of risk that's structured in the right way, that clients have approached the market in the right way. But fundamentally, you know, it's an exciting time because there's so much more focus on it.
Again, I don't think that concept is going to be lost on our listeners, because if you're a fixed income manager or you're an equity manager, you buy hedging products whenever they're cheap, whenever they're out of favor. That's the time to do it. So I think that's maybe something for our private credit managers and our investors to be mindful of, that actually now might be a good opportunity to take coverage and to build some protection. So Ben, specific sectors or types of lending that are difficult to insure?
Yeah, so I guess the first place to kind of lead on from that last point is to remember that, you know, fundamentally, this sector is able to bespoke coverage. So it's not hugely prescriptive. The market has moved. And as we touched on earlier, you know, it's been 100 years of development. The market has moved and flexed with clients. So I don't think there's sort of specific types of lending that are more difficult to insure. Obviously, you know, leverage finance, for example, is more difficult in the market. Real estate finance has been more difficult over recent years. I think really where we've seen it easiest for clients to get insurance tends to be where we've seen, you know, trade-related transactions. They tend to be easier. We've, of course, touched upon a portfolio approach rather than single risk. Similarly, more of a lean towards the developed world tends to be easier. But, you know, again, to previous points, there are insurers who really focus on, you know, developing world only because that's where they get, you know, higher rate. We would say broadly, you know, frontier markets are harder. Africa and China, I think, has become less easy to insure in recent years. Chinese credit specifically has been difficult. Unsecured, less easy as well. I think, you know, security obviously helps insurers. More broadly, shorter term corporate credit. So, you know, financing secured by current assets, you know, receivables, inventory, tends to be the easiest place to start. You know, we at K2 really like that sort of business, for example. And then finally, I think, you know, clients who aim to build relationships, who speak to the market early, you know, whether it's at origination stage, whether it's at fundraising stage, and those who have a consistent approach how and when they use insurance and a consistent approach to relationships, they tend to do better. And we tend to see kind of more success there.
So Ben, just to wrap things up, what are some of the key questions that if I'm an asset manager and I want this type of product, what should I ask my broker? Or if I already have the product, what should I ask my broker about it?
Sure, great question. So I think an important question is, who are the specialists in this area? So who do you really want to focus on? Because, you know, fundamentally, we're probably talking about realistically 3 or 4 different insurers who may be on your panel. You want to find a broker who are focusing on your kind of area of the market. And as touched on, you want someone who facilitates relationships, who facilitates face-to-face discussions. You want to be sitting in the room with insurers who are prepared to take the time to understand your approach to risk, how your fund is structured, why you should be a good person for them to offer coverage to.
I think that's great advice. And Josh, from the perspective of the investor, I have a portfolio of private credit and private debt managers. What should I be asking my private debt and private credit managers about this type of product?
Yeah, so I think if you're an investor and you're invested in funds that currently don't make use of non-payment insurance products, you probably want to ask your manager whether it's something that they've explored. Often off the back of these sorts of products, investors might be able to increase allocations beyond an internal thresholds. Equally, you know, it's a great way to de-risk the portfolio more broadly, particularly during times of economic instability. As we've discussed, you know, that sort of long-term relationship approach is important. And if that's something that you embed within your broader strategy, i.e. the use of credit insurance, it really should be there through the cycle. Making sure that they're engaging specialist brokers to advise them on the structure of these products and obtaining the most competitive quotes, the most appropriate quotes is important. And for investors who are invested in funds who may currently use the credit insurance product to some extent already, what's really, really crucial is making sure that the insurance product is fit for purpose. So again, making sure that a specialist broker was consulted in the placement of the product. I think where we've seen challenges in the past for investors and for asset managers alike is where a product has been to some extent misused or misappropriated, where, you know, a product might be specifically designed to capture the funding of international trade transactions. The reality is that that's not what the underlying risk is. And therefore, you know, when a loss occurs, the policy doesn't trigger. So making sure that you have an appropriate bespoke policy is really crucial.
Ben and Josh, thank you very much for coming today to share your insights. I think that was a fantastic description of this part of the insurance world, which, as you've described, you know, could have huge impact and for private credit and private debt managers as a risk management solution. Thank you for your continued support of the SBAI, and thank you to K2 as well. It's been fantastic speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having us.
don't forget to visit our website, sbai.org, and sign up to our newsletter. You can find our previous podcast episodes on topics such as culture, carbon, and China on our website. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.